via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. An independent special panel of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved for emergency use a coronavirus vaccine developed by U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech. The majority of panelists voted yes for the vaccine's emergency use based on the totality of scientific evidence available. Do the benefits of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine outweigh its risk for use in individuals 16 years of age and older? The FDA will likely give its final consent as early as Friday or Saturday. The U.S. government will immediately ship just over 6 million doses of the vaccine across the country, with frontline healthcare workers receiving top priority for the first inoculations. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine jumped to the front of the line in the global effort to develop a vaccine against the coronavirus. Britain became the first Western nation to begin mass inoculations of the drug on Tuesday, just days after the government's medical regulatory agency approved the drug. Nigeria's health minister warning the country may be on the verge of a second wave of COVID-19 infections, as another official said the country expects to roll out a vaccine by April next year. The health minister later in the briefing said Nigeria hoped to start with at least 20 million doses of the COVAX facility, initially covering healthcare workers and vulnerable people who would be most at risk, such as the elderly. On Thursday, the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urged rich countries that ordered more COVID-19 vaccines than they need to consider distributing excess doses to Africa. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. U.S. congressional leaders are still at a stalemate on extending programs that are helping millions of Americans weather the economic impact of closures due to the coronavirus pandemic. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, told reporters the negotiations that have dragged on for several months are now making great progress. Lawmakers will buy themselves another week of time to negotiate a deal on coronavirus aid by passing a one-week extension of government funding that was set to expire on December 11. With time running out ahead of the holidays and the start of a new Congress in early January, legislators are expected to combine any deal reached on aid with a longer-term extension of government funding. Earlier in the year, Americans received as much as $1,200 in direct payments after the first round of closures to limit the spread of the pandemic. The U.S. military dispatched two B-52 bombers from the U.S. to the Middle East Thursday as part of an ongoing effort to deter Iran from potential attacks amid increased risk in the region. This, according to a senior U.S. military official. The mission to the region was designed to deter aggression, reassure allies, according to a statement from the U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the Middle East. Last month, the Pentagon announced it would withdraw 500 American troops from Iraq before next year, U.S. presidential inauguration. Tensions have remained high between the U.S. and Iran over the past year. China's foreign ministry announced that U.S. diplomatic passport holders visiting Hong Kong and nearby Mao will temporarily now no longer receive visa privileges, restrictions of what China's foreign ministry spokesperson described as reciprocal sanctions. The reference is most likely to sanctions that bar certain Chinese and government officials from traveling to the U.S. The U.S. military killed 8 al-Shabaab fighters and wounded 2 others in airstrikes Thursday in Somalia. General Stephen Townsend of the U.S. Africa Command said the military will continue to apply pressure to the al-Shabaab network. They continue to undermine Somali's sea security and need to be contained and degraded. The al-Qaeda affiliate terror group conduct dozens of car bombings across Somalia each year, including against citizens, government, and American targets. The strike comes days after President Trump ordered the Pentagon to remove the majority of the 700 U.S. military troops stationed in Somalia. For details on more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Reporting remotely, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. recognizes Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara.
The main difficulties I see is that if this policy is sustained in the future, it will complicate the Security Council's efforts to tackle the Western Sahara problem.
We'll also get reaction from the Polisario. South Sudan's parties agreed to complete formation of state government and national assembly. Somalia struggles to hold an indirect election. And Ghana's opposition candidate refuses to accept the presidential election results.
If we are to progress as a nation, the sacred verdict of the people must be respected. And that is why I stand before you tonight and willing to accept the fictionalized results of a flawed election.
And Malawi's president announces strict measures against the perpetrators of gender-based violence. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former United Nations official says if the U.S. recognition of Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara is sustained, in the future, it will complicate the Security Council's efforts to resolve the Western Sahara problem. Ambassador James Jonah, former U.N. Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, says the U.N. has an established policy that the final status of the Western Sahara will be determined by a referendum. President Donald Trump signed a proclamation on Thursday recognizing Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara. He says support for Morocco's autonomy is the only basis for a just and lasting solution to the dispute over the Western Sahara territory. Ambassador Jonah says it is possible that another U.S. administration could reverse the decision, but if it is sustained and the U.S. uses its veto power in the Security Council, it could complicate efforts to resolve the Western Sahara issues.
The main difficulties I see is that if this policy is sustained in the future, it will complicate the Security Council's efforts to tackle the Western Sahara problem.
Why do you say that?
Because the United Nations has established a policy whereby it says the final status of Western Sahara will be determined by a referendum. The General Assembly has taken a firm position and even granted Polisario, the group fighting for Western Sahara, a status in the General Assembly. Even in the Security Council, when the Council meets to discuss Western Sahara, the Polisario representative is invited to speak. And this will complicate the problem amongst Security Council members. It may not prevent Polisario to speak, because it may be just a procedural issue. But if the U.S. maintains its position, it could use its veto right in the Security Council.
Do you think, Ambassador Jonas, this decision can be reversed by another U.S. administration?
That's why I said if it is sustained in the future. I don't want to predict what any other administration would do. Of course, they can change the policy. We have had many instances when policies have changed in an administration. It depends on how they see the problem. Yes, of course, it's possible.
So why do you think, Ambassador Jonas, that the Trump administration has put forward this policy?
It's very, very difficult to fathom what is happening in the last days of the administration. All I can say is, although President Trump did not say it in his announcements about recognizing the sovereignty of Morocco on Western Sahara, other news reports have linked the recognition to issues about Morocco trying to deal its relationship with Israel. But he didn't say it, but they said this is part of a quid pro quo.
You mentioned referendum in the Western Sahara.
if there is a referendum, who will organize this referendum and who is going to participate in it?
That is the rub of a problem. The Secretary General of the United Nations, going way back to that time of Secretary General Kurt Waldheim, was authorized by the Council to appoint a special representative, which he did, and that representative was to organize a referendum. The problem then is who should participate? There has been no agreement between Morocco and Polisario, so there have not been any referendum. And that's why the whole issue has not been finally resolved.
Ambassador Jonas, it's always very nice to talk with you, and thank you for your perspective.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ambassador James Jonas is the former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. He was speaking with us from New York City. Meanwhile, Omar Sidi, the Polisario representative to the United Nations, says the U.S. recognition of Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara is another escalation of U.S. interference in African affairs.
United States recognition of sovereignty of Kingdom of Morocco of Western Sahara is another escalation in U.S. foreign interference in African affairs. Western Sahara is a disputed territory which was occupied by Morocco since 1975. And the people in Western Sahara have all rights to self-determination. And the UN Security Council extended the mandate of the UN mission for referendum in Western Sahara by 13 votes just recently. So this move by United States is a big blow to democracy and undermines the efforts that United Nations is making to resolve the conflict. I appeal to the African Union to step up so that there is no further escalation of the conflict and ensure that United States respects the sovereignty of Africa to determine its own issues.
That was Omar Sidi, the Polisario representative to the United Nations. In Ghana, opposition candidate and former President John Dramani Mahama says he will not accept what he calls fictionalized election results. Ghanaians voted on Monday this week in presidential and parliamentary elections, and the Electoral Commission announced that incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo won re-election. But addressing a news conference Thursday evening, Mahama accused the Electoral Commission of manipulating the results.
My brothers and sisters, there's no doubt that Ghanaians from every region of this great nation of ours voted for change. And we did so in both the presidential and parliamentary elections. I'm a staunch believer in the experiment of democracy, a system of governance that allows the ultimate decision-making power to rest in the hands of you, the good people of Ghana. We, the people, who with an eye towards the future we would like for our dear country, elect representatives to go forward and realize that vision. Government serves at the choice, direction, and pleasure of the people of this great nation. And I have had the honor and privilege to serve my country in all levels of government. When in 2016, at the end of my first full term as president, I ran for re-election as an incumbent candidate, I respected the will of the people. I conceded, I stepped aside, and I set in motion a peaceful transfer of power because I understood that it was the will of the people. And if we are to progress as a nation, if we are to live up to the inheritance of our history, one for which people have paid the ultimate price, the sacred verdict of the people must be respected. It must be protected. It has been my pledge throughout my time of service as a representative to the good people of Ghana to do exactly that. And that is why I stand before you tonight, unwilling to accept the fictionalized results of a flawed election. My brothers and sisters, it is important to remember that the government that is in power controls all of the state resources and oversees all of the state's institutions. The line he treads between his loyalty to the power that is held by the people and by his own desire to hold on to power can be a very thin one indeed. We went into the 2020 presidential and parliamentary elections with assurances from the Electoral Commission and the relevant state actors that it will be conducted in an atmosphere free from fear and that it will be fair, transparent, and credible. Unfortunately, that has not been the case. What we witnessed across the country from Monday, 7th December 2020, exposed a deliberate plan to manipulate and predetermine the results of the election in favor of the incumbent candidate, Nana Akufo-Addo, who, as so happens, controls all of the state resources and oversees the state institutions.
That was former Ghanaian president and opposition presidential candidate John Dramani Mahama speaking Thursday night in Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 11th. Somalia is struggling to hold an indirect election that will determine the next president after opposition candidates accused President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo of stalking the election committee. The opposition have defiantly formed their own parallel committee, delaying the election and prompting international concern. Mohamed Kahija reports from Mogadishu.
There are more than 10 candidates in Somalia's indirect presidential elections in which Fulbe clans and other minority tribes choose members of parliament that will decide on the country's next head of state. The opposition accused the president, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, of bypassing the electoral law by stacking the poll committee with his allies. The committee coordinates the parliamentary elections before the presidential poll. Abdurrahman Abdishakur, one of the key opposition figures, told VOA News that the president put members of National Intelligence Agency, known as NISA, on the committee.
Our concern is about how the committee was made of. And we have some of the members, or majority of the members, are from the NISA, National Security Agency, and some of them are from the civil servants, and some of them are known supporters of the current president, Farmajo.
The international community, including the United States, has raised concerns about the political standoff in a country that's already facing threats from the armed group Al-Shabaab. Ambassador Donald Yamamoto warned the opposition groups against subverting the election process.
The opposition must reaffirm that there is no parallel process, there is no delay, there is no change to the September 17th consensus agreement. The United States and all the donor communities and partners are concerned about the electoral impasse.
The United States' recent announcement that it will withdraw its 700 troops who help the Somali Security Agency's battle Al-Shabaab has further threatened Somalia's already fragile stability. Abdul Rashid Hashi, an analyst at Heritage Institute for Policy Studies, says the Somali government needs to show stronger leadership.
They are responsible for the security and well-being and political stability of the country, and they need to just sit with their colleagues. People who are, you know, they are arguing with are their predecessors. The former presidents are the ones that are actually leading the opposition groups.
Citizens like student Shafi Yusuf hope that there will be a peaceful poll where the outcome will be accepted by all sides in the race. He says, we need free and fair elections in which the results are accepted by all citizens, like previous transparent poll processes, with the winner supported by the whole political spectrum. Somali Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble pledged his administration will address all concerns raised about the elections, which are scheduled for February. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
South Sudan's two main parties have agreed to end their disagreement on the formation of state governments and the reconstitution of the National Legislative Assembly. The decision was reached at a meeting held on Wednesday this week and attended by both President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar, the leader of the SPLMIO. South Sudan presidential spokesperson Atain Wek Atain says the agreement calls for President Salva Kiir to appoint the state and local governments of nine states except for Upper Nile State.
It is true, the meeting of the presidency took place yesterday, and the presidency agreed to form the state government, of which the president will be the appointing authority until the state's constitution are revitalized. And the peace agreement is incorporated into the state constitutions.
Can you explain, it says the president's objective of the meeting was to discuss the establishment of states and local governments. The meeting resolved that the president appoints the state and local governments of nine states, except that of Upper Nile. Why is this important?
It's important in the fact that, you know, in Upper Nile, it has not yet been resolved. It is constitutionally viable for the president to appoint the United States government and keep the issue of Upper Nile pending until it is resolved. So it was quite significant that, you know, the president and the first vice president has agreed to allow the state government, the United States, with the exception of Upper Nile, to go on and form their government.
So when do you expect that the president will begin the process now, putting together, for example, the transitional National Legislative Assembly and the Council of State's Cabinet Affairs Minister? When would that take place?
No, it will be as soon as possible. You know, the president has been also given the go-ahead to appoint the United States government. And he can do so anytime from now.
When you talk to the SPLIO people, they say perhaps, why is the South Sudan Defense Forces, why do they continue to attack the SPLM forces?
I am not sure of any attack by the government forces against the SPLM-IO forces. It is the SPLM-IO forces that has some holds-out group which are not coming to Juba, including their chief of staff is not in Juba, and they are not in the controlling area. So it is the SPLM-IO to explain exactly which part of the forces of the SPLM-IO they are talking about. Because you cannot count the SPLM-IO forces because they are not in the designated place.
I know now that with this agreement, the implementation of the peace process will go ahead, but there are still outstanding issues, one of them being the cantonment of forces. Is it true that your government is saying that you need more funding to complete this?
Well, all the components of the agreement requires funding in order to complete all the process of implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. You know, although the government of South Sudan will try to raise funds in order to implement the remaining part of the agreement, it will be incumbent upon the international community to also provide help in some areas to ensure the implementation is done once and for all.
Ateng Wek Ateng is the spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. You're speaking with us from the capital, Juba. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera has announced the plans for stiffer penalties against those who commit gender-based violence following a jump in cases during the coronavirus pandemic. In a national address for Human Rights Day yesterday, Thursday, Chakwera said Malawi would also require the teaching of human rights in schools. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
President Chakwera said figures from the National Statistics Office on gender-based violence are worrying.
3 years ago, the National Statistics Office reported that one in three Malawian women and girls between the age of 15 and 49 experiences physical or sexual violence. To make matters worse, cases of these crimes have since been going up. And in the last 3 months of this year alone, the rate has been 35% higher than the same period last year.
Chakwera said the trend shows that under the restrictions on movement put in place to fight COVID-19, gender-based crimes have been widespread. He announced plans for stiffer penalties against those who commit gender-based violence.
The Ministries of Justice and Gender under my administration will prepare amendments to relevant pieces of legislation, including the Criminal Procedure and Evidence Code, to fast-track the disposal of such cases, to exact stiffer mandatory penalties against culprits, and to establish a sex offenders register.
Chakwera also said Malawi would require the teaching of human rights in schools. For the past 2 months, rights campaigners have been holding a series of protests against continued cases of rape and sexual abuse of girls and women. During protests in November, Women Doctors Association in Malawi and other rights activists gave President Chakwera 90 days to present measures to help end the sexual abuse. New cases of rape and sexual abuse against women and girls are reported in Malawi near every week. On Thursday, a local media reported that police in the southern Mangochi district have arrested a 33-year-old man for raping three sisters aged between 12 and 14. One of them is now pregnant. Maggie Katewera Banda is the executive director for Women's Manifesto Movement. She says a big problem is that current laws are not enforced.
I think we are not addressing the real issue, because if you look at what is the maximum sentence, they are saying you can go even up to death sentence. Because for me, I think in Malawi, it's more about implementation of our laws rather than the laws themselves. I think over years we have tried to come up with gender laws, but you find that they are not being implemented.
Immaculate Maluza is president for Women Lawyers Association in Malawi. She says attitudes toward gender-based violence must change.
And also deal with the toxic traits in our culture that promote violence against women to reflect the period that we're in now.
Maluza says steps should be taken to criminalize harmful cultural practices that tolerate violence against women. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the World Indoor Athletics Championship in Nanjing, China, which have been pushed back again to March 2023 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. World Athletics on Thursday said while the shift remains regrettable, it acknowledged that there is still significant uncertainty about the state of the COVID-19 pandemic in the early part of 2021 when the championship was slated to take place. World Athletics added that this was done in consideration for the safety of athletes and technical officials. World record breaker Mando Duplantis of Sweden was named World Athletics Male Athlete of the Year in the virtual ceremony last weekend. But for Ugandan long-distance runner Joshua Cheptegei, who holds the 5,000 meters and 10,000 meters world records, both set in 2020, he believes he merited the award more.
It's really a great team that I was not able to be named the World Athlete of the Year. Even after last year, I was so sure that I would be the World Athlete of the Year. I had won the World Cross Country, won the Diamond League, and won the World Championship. And now this year being a very difficult year where I broke 3 world records, it's a shame that the World Athletics were not able to consider that. And maybe I will have to change my colors. Maybe if I was a white, I would have won it.
Staying with athletics, 2-time world half marathon champion Peres Jepchirchir believes she deserves a Team Kenyan ticket to the 2020 Olympic Games set for next year in Tokyo, Japan. Fresh from winning the Valencia Marathon with a course record, the world half marathon record holder said her ambitions will be fulfilled once she gets an opportunity to fly the Kenyan flag in the Japanese capital. Jepchirchir ran the 5th fastest time over the 42 kilometers race while winning the Valencia Marathon on Sunday, clocking 2 hours, 17 minutes, 16 seconds. In rugby news, reigning world champions South Africa will end the year as the number one team in the latest world rugby rankings despite having not played a test match in more than a year. The Springboks, whose last match was the Rugby World Cup final win against England in November 2019, currently top the rankings with 94.2 points. South Africa is well ahead of second-placed England, which recently won the inaugural Autumn Nations Cup and has 89.4 points. And onto basketball, Mali won their second straight FIBA Under-18 Men African Championship title after edging Senegal 82-80 in Wednesday's final at the Cairo Stadium. Borama Koulibaly dropped a game high of 21 points, 5 assists and 5 rebounds to inspire Mali to a surprise win over Senegal, who has been marked as favorites. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, December 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, the reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Vartey in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.